up all the teachers. Time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back for those who have been with me from the start, and for those who are new, hello again. Last week, I sort of went over a brief history of school or education social reform movements. And I promised that this week I would go a little more into those histories and try and point out some commonality of those movements and work our way up from after the revolution all the way up to where we are today. But what I'm going to do today is work us up to the period just around 1950. And the launch of Sputnik. And I'm going to ask anyone out there besides me know about the launch of Sputnik and what I'm talking about. Think about it, and when I get to it, I'll raise that question again, and I'll try and give you some answers to it. One of the things that I want to emphasize is that knowing the history of public education in schools in our country is very important. Knowing the history of the various school social reform movements is also very important. And if by chance you don't see the importance of knowing this history, let me refer you back to something a guy by the name of Edmund Burke stated. Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. I'm sure many, if not all of you, have heard that sentiment. Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. We have had tons of reform school movements. Many have been failures. A few have been very successful. There have been proponents and opponents to these movements. There have been coalitions coming together to press their vision for improving education. There are those who wanted to change it. It's all over the map. And what I want to drive home right now is that I started our first episode by saying that today those people who call themselves education reformers, in my view, are not education reformers. They have an entirely different agenda than past education reformers have had. Their agenda and their movement is totally different than what past movements were. And I want to point out taking for, depending on when you look at it, from 30 to 35 years in the making. It has ramped up to steroid strength and speed over the last 10, 12 years, Bush administration and the Obama administration. Their movement has been lights out successful, just totally steamrolling over every aspect of public education. Their plan, their strategy, their methods are, from a strategic standpoint, I have to say they're awesome. Beyond awesome, they're fantastic. And I concluded that the reason their movement has been so successful and so devastating is that they knew the history of school reform movements backwards and forward. And they learned what made movements successful, what made movements failure. And in designing their movement, they didn't leave anything to chance. And I'm convinced that the people who put the strategy together definitely knew the history of school reform movements in this country. And all the mistakes that were made previously, they developed a strategy to not repeat those failures. So that's just one of the reasons why I think it's critically important that you stick around. We've gone through some of this, and we'll go through a little more so that you too will be knowledgeable and be able to better understand the current movement and hopefully make a decision as to where you stand in this movement for the corporate reform model or the resistance to that model with the aim of defeating it as soon as possible. So, with that in mind, I want to go into our talk for today. There have been tons of school reform movements over the last 150 years or so. As I just stated, most of those movements failed. Few of them succeeded. And one of the first movement exactly was what was called the Common School Movement. It was the first one, and it was the most successful movement thus far. Many of the goals and objectives of the movement are still in play today, somewhere in the U.S. and other parts of the world. And many of the succeeding movements took their cue from this first movement, the Common School Movement. In the past, I've told you that almost all of the movements were a response to a real or perceived or manufactured crisis. And our first movement was born of a crisis. And the crisis was, as I sort of mentioned in the past, that the country, after the successful conclusion of the Revolutionary War, was growing exponentially, people coming in from all over the world to partake of the freedom and the opportunities that the new republic offered. And this rapid expansion of the population, and as I said previously, where they settle in cities, bringing with them different values, different customs, different beliefs, religion, was perceived as a potential problem sometime, somewhere down the line. And the solution that was offered and put in place was to set up a public school system. Public being that the school system would be taxpayer paid for and overseen by the government or its representative, and that it would be a national effort. We see a problem, and we see how people decided that education was the solution. Those two go hand in hand, and they have never been separated in 150 plus years of public education in this country. You have a crisis, you have a social problem, public schools was the preferred solution. In that particular time period after the revolution, there were two critical elements that were perceived to be the problems. One was, how do we provide equality of conditions for all of our citizens? And how do we develop a strong cultural civic commitment in the people who are already here, born here, grew up here, and the people who are coming in? If we don't solve one or both of those problems, then we're going to have a big problem, because our little fragile new republic could possibly be destroyed. So we see for the first time that education was a preferred solution to a major, major perceived social problem. And this would be repeated, as I said earlier, time and time again. At that time, there were competing groups in terms of vision of what this public school system should be. And what resulted was what they even called back then, I think, was a grand bargain between the democratic politics and the capitalist markets. There were people back then who wanted to shape this new idea of a national public school system along the lines of the emerging capital market that was taking place in this country. Others were more interested in developing schools that would have as its goal the democratic politics of learning to love this country, its values, its tradition, commit to them, to protect them, to perpetuate them into the very distant future. So we have this common school movement, and a name that for those of us who are in education that is very familiar to us, one of the largest proponents of this was a guy by the name of Horace Mann. Many people in education consider him to be the father of public education. And it was his vision of what public education should be in schools, and his strong personality and ability to articulate and persuade others to his vision of what public schools should be for, and he won over. And he put us on the road to the type of public schools that we have today. Now, the people who were pushing for a capitalistic market approach to schools, they didn't win, but they also didn't go away. What happened was that they sort of like faded to the background, or what I said earlier, the shadows, and they have always been in the shadows. Any and every opportunity that came their way, they would try to influence the reform movement to incorporate their ideas, their values, their beliefs as to what public schools should be all about. Even Horace Mann recognized that this group was very important to helping bring public education into existence. He wasn't a proponent of the business model of education, but he was a realist, pragmatic, and so he nodded to them and tried to incorporate some of their ideas in our first public school establishment. He is also known to have said that putting them in play was merely an effort to gain support for a higher and more noble mission of supporting the Republic community. And so it was sort of like a backdoor recognition and a nod to them, but thinking that basically they are of little or no relevance to the making of the public school system. That movement lasted for several decades, and as I said earlier, it was, to this day, the most successful reform movement ever. After that movement was put in place, there developed a perception that, well, we have this system, but it's not really working. It's not working the way it should work and the way it can work. And a second major movement started, and that movement was the progressive movement. And it was at a time when there was progressive political movement, and then the progressive school reform movement. They sort of went hand in hand, and their objective was to, well, the problem that they saw first was finding a way for government and society to manage the new environment. And by new environment, and I've stated this somewhat briefly in the past, this new environment was a new corporate economy that was developing, a growing inequality, angry labor movement or labor relations, growth in the cities, and a huge wave of immigrants from southern and eastern Europe. People saw this as the making of a crisis. The crisis wasn't as threatening as the first perceived crisis, but it was going to be very problematic. So, what was the solution to the problem? Let's turn to education again and develop programs to meet head-on with these perceived coming problems. You see a theme or pattern developing here? Crisis, search for a solution, solution, public education. As an aside, let me just say, that model, whereas it, on the surface, worked, in reality, it didn't. And one of the reasons, and perhaps maybe the most important reason, was that the problems that were developing were not directly attacked by the government. It was an indirect attack using schools to solve social problems. And as a result, it put a burden on this new public school system that over the years it couldn't handle. And that's one of the main reasons that subsequent school reform movements after the common school movement didn't have the success as that earlier movement, had many failures and short shelf life to a considerable extent. So we see here one thing that I want to drive home. Schools, public education will and can solve all social problems. As time would go on, we would see that subsequent movements aimed at solving different problems, and what we can glean from some of those other movements was the development of a core set of values that drove the movement and public schools themselves. And there were four such values. They were a desire to improve efficiency. Let me stop. As I tick off these values, keep in mind that the current social corporate reform movement are espousing some of the same values that their movement is based on that were espoused 150 years ago. An example of them studying history. So, back to what I was saying. A desire to improve efficiency, to raise standards of excellence, to enhance the child fully. By that, they were talking about developing a full range of the child's potential and powers, and to increase equity. Those were the four values that have driven most of our educational reform movements over the years. We're going to take a little break here, but before we do, I'm reminded that I need to once again tell you that there is a toll-free number that you can use to call in and talk to me live, pose questions, have a dialogue. That number is 888-627-6008. I'll repeat, 888-627-6008. We're going to take a short break, and I'll see you on the other side of the break. Okay, we're back. I was just mentioning the four primary values that have more or less driven various school reform movements. let me go into them a little more for you. One of the first ones was the efficiency reform. Here we had four themes that were very prominent here. One was new types of schools. We saw the introduction of junior high and community colleges. Another was new tracks within schools, such as vocational and commercial tracks in high school. Then we had new standardized categories, such as course credit units, standard division and school day, standardized education requirements for teachers, setting of requirements for students to accomplish in order to graduate. These things were part of the efficiency value that drove some of the future school reform movement. Another was the excellence movement. This demanded a new curriculum, new subjects. Today it would be computers in school. In the past, it was maybe adding history, adding something in the area of vocational training, just something that would expand the curriculum and make it more relevant for the times. New instructional methods, like new math, or new way of, well, not today would be keyboarding as opposed to handwriting. Upgrading teacher training standards. Remember, in the colonial period and thereafter, children were educated by parents, by church, some civic groups. Children of the wealthy, they had private tutors who were more skillful in the knowledge of the day. So this new emphasis here was to bring in the idea of training people to do teaching. Take out the haphazard, random approach, more or less standardize it, and produce, hopefully, quality teachers. You see, during this movement, the development of schools of education, teacher training, teacher sort of certification. Later on in this movement, you would see the development of professional administrators. So that there was a perceived deficiency problem here, and the solution was to create training vehicles for our professional educators. Well, actually making them professional educators. And as I mentioned before, establishing and then upgrading graduation standards. Next would be new and more challenging evaluation of both students and, would you believe it, back then, teachers. Yes, back then, they had state or national proficiency tests for the training of teachers. And then the idea of measuring student growth and development in terms of academics. And let me interrupt for a second. As I tick these off, think about when you were in school. Some of this has got to sound very familiar to all of us, both when we were in school and for those who are involved in the current corporate reform war, you see, again, part of this war, that playbook comes right out of the reform movement's going back to 150 years or more. It just blows my mind every time I think about this. But anyway, I said that. Okay. Then there was the notion of longer school days and school years. Again, we can all relate to this. But another reform movement value was the enhancement reform. Here we talked about new types of schools. Kindergarten makes its debut. Alternative schools make their debut. Faculty and activity add-on, like the opening of multi-purpose rooms, extracurricular activities, and today it would be computer labs. New child development ideas, the idea of relating curriculum to the development of the child, subject appropriate for a child at any given age. We see also here the introduction of physical education. And I'm going to say something about that a little later, how that came really about. Then we see an emphasis on the student-centered instruction, learning by doing, field trips, open classrooms. These things that, many of us experience in our education days. And our children are experiencing them today. How about this one? And I know anyone out there who went to public schools will recognize this one. And that is new classroom amenities. You know, putting up posters, artwork, removable desks or movable desks, activity centers in the room, moving away from having all the desks in a row, from maybe 10 or 15 in a row and 3 or 4 or 5 rows, and the teacher standing up front, and maybe a chalkboard or what we call a blackboard. That went out during this reform movement to bring in more colorful, exciting, intellectually stimulating environment and approaching student learning differently in this new environment. All of these things that I've mentioned so far have all come about through one reform movement or another. The equity reform. New compensatory programs, such as Head Start today, Title I, aid for students with disabilities, then new integration programs, like bilingual education, then new prevention programs for students at risk. Drugs, alcohol, bad conduct, and et cetera. All of these things that we take for granted today, or for some who scorn those things, all came about as a result of a reform movement of one kind or another. And so we see here a pattern developing, and I'll repeat it because I want you to etch it on your eyelids. I'm joking. That schools were conceived of as the place to solve the nation's social problems as they emerge over the years. I bring all of this up because when we get to the current reform movement, you're going to see a vastly different set of values at work, different goals and objectives, and hopefully you'll see why I don't refer to the movement as a real reform movement, because it's not. Recall what I said previously. The reformers in the past were considered do-gooders. More formally, they were considered, reform was considered a deliberate political effort to realize particular social goals and to hopefully incorporate the other things that I mentioned, efficiency and et cetera. Different animal back then than it is today. Going further into this, let's take some examples. When reformers saw a problem or a problem that was coming ahead, they said, okay, let's do something in the school to deal with this. For example, I'm laughing because I mentioned to you last time when I was in junior high, I was tracked into print shop and the girls were sent over to typing. And it was just one of the many problems that they saw and used the school to deal with. But take, for example, back then, big problem with poor public health. You know, all the people coming from different places, crowding into the city, slum conditions, disease developing and spreading, and et cetera. So what was proposed to deal with this threat was, how about health education course? Yes, our first health education course was a result of a crisis, and the school was tasked with the job of coming up with a solution, and the solution was developing health education classes. How about in the areas of once a person gets married, how do you develop a healthy household relation between husband and wife and children? Well, you develop a class that will teach young children the knowledge and skills they need to develop and live in a happy home. I don't know about you guys, but I actually took a course in my senior year on, I can't remember the name now, but basically it was like a home ed class teaching us how to, I'm a senior in high school, teaching us how to understand our roles as husband and wife, men and women, how to prepare our home for arrival of children, and relationships between men and women. And by the way, it was also a course that was very controversial at the time because parents didn't think that school should teach such things. Also, there was a problem with not having these new arrivals in our country, as well as our own kids, knowledgeable and skillful enough to work in the new corporate economy. So, created a class. And you also created tracks, as I mentioned earlier, vocational programs, vocational ed, which included, as I mentioned previously, wood shop, metal shop, for me, print shop, typing, shorthand, car repair, bookkeeping, cosmetology. These were all subjects that were introduced as a way to deal with a present future problem. Drugs. We started having drug and alcohol problems way back, decades ago. Not so much the drugs, but the alcohol problem. Schools were called on to develop a course or courses to deal with alcohol problems. Kids were growing up malnutrition, out of shape, overweight. Guess what? Developed PE classes. Kids during the summer in the cities didn't have anything to do, got into trouble. We developed summer school to deal with it. And I can go on with a list of things that came about as a result of, again, my theme of perceived crisis, the search for solutions, and calling upon the school to solve the problems. Now, I had mentioned earlier that there were reform movements that failed, few that succeeded. What I just told you about the various reform movements and what came out of these movements? What came out of these movements contributed to those that succeeded, also contributed to those that failed. Let me restate that for you, because what I'm saying is that asking the schools to solve all of these social problems, as well as trying to educate people to be good citizens, support the republic, and have skills necessary for the new corporate capitalism that was emerging, that was asking a whole lot. And then not providing the funds for these reforms, and those people who were for it and against it would cause several of these major reforms to fail. So it was like good news, bad news. We see a problem, let's go fix it, let's have the school do it, and then the school takes a shot at it, and they don't get the job done, hence the schools are a problem. Schools are failing our students. They're putting the nation at risk because they cannot and have not solved the problems that we have asked them to solve. That's a theme that will be repeated over and over and over again. I want you to think of that theme as reform to the rescue. We have a problem. Reform the schools. They will rescue us. If you remember that, then you'll remember a lot of what I've said without having remembered the details. Okay, we're going to take our last break. So see you in a few minutes, and we'll close out. Okay, we're back. Let me finish off by just briefly mentioning some more reforms, but without going into details, that would take place from the early, mid-1900s to about 1950s, 1960s. Because as most of, I'm going to say most, as many of you may know, the 60s was a turbulent time. And we saw many social movements developing, the integration or racial equality movement, creating equal access to quality education as opposed to the separate but equal doctrine that had been in play for decades, anti-war movement, anti-poverty movement, women's movement, ecology movement, all of these movements would take shape during the 60s. And again, many of those movements would take their cue from the previous movements in education. So there's a link there, there's a nexus there that I want you to be aware of. I mentioned at the beginning, we would go up to Sputnik. I wished I could see hands or anything of those of you who remember Sputnik. For those of you who don't, a little history. At the end of World War II, the U.S. coming in from the west in Germany, the Russians coming in from the east, both countries were desperately trying to grab up as many of the scientists that had developed the first rockets, and they were developing the A-bomb, or the hydrogen bomb. We got our share of those scientists. Russia got its share. We go into the Cold War, where Russia had vowed to crush the West, and we had vowed to crush the Russians and communism. We were, as a country, we were going like gangbusters. Our factories were turning out new products. Our economy was growing. Education was growing. Everything was growing. And we were ahead of the Russians. Until one day, something happened. Sputnik. The Russians sent up an unmanned spacecraft with the monkey in it that went into outer space and was able to return to Earth's atmosphere, and the monkey was in good shape. This event scared the hell out of us as a nation. The Russians had beat us to space. The idea of whether or not they were going to beat us to manufacturing and mass, weapons of mass destruction, the A-bomb, the hydrogen bomb, was immediately thrust in everyone's mind that if they could send a man or an animal to space, they certainly could send a bomb from Russia to New York, Chicago, and what have you. Something really, I want to call it weird, but that's an understatement. American schools were singled out and blamed for this event. The event being letting the Russians get to outer space before us. Our schools were failing because we weren't turning out smart people in abundance, in math, in science, engineering, and et cetera, whereas the Russians were, and as a result, they had gained an advantage. That was a major, major crisis. And it was the beginning of a 35 to 50 year effort to reform our schools to what the reform movement looks like today. Again, I don't know how much you know about the Sputnik era, and I don't want to belabor the point, but if you're going to remember something, remember Sputnik, because it changed the face of this country, and it changed our whole approach to education. Sputnik would be followed by a report that would be issued by a very, quote, prestigious committee who were tasked with assessing the status of public education in America. At the time, it was President Reagan who put together this prestigious committee with the goal that this committee would come back with a report that would enable him to begin the process of dismantling public education. The committee came back with a report, and a report was called A Nation at Risk. And the report itself thwarted Reagan's primary goal of having something that he could point to as for his reasons for dismantling public education. A Nation at Risk would be followed by a little thing called No Child Left Behind. I'm sure anyone now who is 10 years old or older, 5 years old, will have some idea about what I'm talking about here. A nation, from A Nation at Risk to No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind would give rise to, as I mentioned in the past, Obama's program, Race to the Top. And what all of this would have in common would be the goal to destroy public education and erect a national privatized corporate education system, going from education as a public good to the education system being a private good. I brought us up to where we're really going to start getting into what this show is all about when we start talking about this latter 50, 60 years of reform and how this current reform, corporate reform, is a war, unlike all the previous reforms that were aimed at changing, improving, but not destroying. I see I've gone over my time. I hope you got something out of this, and that I will see you in a couple of weeks. Have a good day, everyone.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.